cat who he injected with insulin twice a day.
Yes.
Also died as David was taken to the hospital.
Yeah, after David was taken to the hospital.
His cat, Shaman.
Shaman died, yes. It was tragic all around, but at least David never knew that Shaman had died.
They were very close.
Oh, absolutely.
On that note, we're going to wrap up this part of the discussion, but Jeremy, I'm going to ask you to stay on, and we're going to do part two and hear David McReynolds talking about pacifism and why he was a socialist. Yes, David McReynolds ran for president twice on the Socialist USA Party ticket, longtime pacifist with the War Resisters League. Ed Hedeman, his colleague at the WRL, and investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill both knew him for decades. That does it for our show. Check our Part 2 conversation at democracynow.org under web exclusives. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hey Boo Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the August Amazee After Dark, featuring Insexuality, Ultrasonic Love Songs, and Death Dances from the Panamanian Rainforest, on Wednesday, August 29th at 7:30 p.m. at Amazee in Portland. What does the world sound like to an insect? Or a bat? You can find out by exploring the insect music you've never heard before in surround sound under the Panamanian stars. Again, that's Amazee After Dark, featuring Insexuality, Ultrasonic Love Songs, and Death Dances from the Panamanian Rainforest, on Wednesday, August 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, 1945 Southeast Water Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, air quality in the Pacific Northwest continues to be hazardous for sensitive groups.
Protesters confront Mayor Ted Wheeler over the presence of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement prison in Portland.
And in international news, Venezuela's new currency may not be the solution to the nation's hyperinflation.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 20th, 2018. I'm Summer Barraza.
And I'm Ken Jones. An air quality advisory has been issued for much of the Pacific Northwest after wildfire smoke and haze returned to the area earlier today. The National Weather Service issued the alert for much of western Oregon and southwest Washington. The advisory will remain in effect until midweek. Air quality is expected to worsen through this evening until Wednesday afternoon, when western winds are expected to blow away much of the smoke. Small children, pregnant women, those with heart disease or respiratory ailments, and the elderly should try to stay indoors as much as possible. In Portland, the air quality index is around 120, which is considered unhealthy for sensitive groups. In Hillsboro, the index passed 150, meaning it's unhealthy for everyone. Mount Hood National Forest is up to 180. The Dalles is at a moderate 87, while Corvallis is in the high 70s.
Despite increased attention from police, protesters outside City Hall continue to confront Portland's Mayor Ted Wheeler over the presence of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement prison in Portland. ICE has yet to fully obey the national court order to reunite children who were abducted from their parents at the border. The ongoing 24-hour encampment in downtown Portland is being confronted with threats and harassment from passing motorists. KABU reporter Teresa Mitchell was there this weekend to speak with the protesters. One of them is Danielle James, standing across from City Hall, who is calling for Mayor Ted Wheeler to take the example of some of the nation's sheriffs and refuse to cooperate with ICE.
Okay, so Danielle, I have a note that says persons at the camp downtown have been detained for long periods of time. One person, Will, perhaps, is that right, has been detained long as 10 days, not been allowed to talk to his lawyer or visit. He's been excluded from visitors. He has a court date possibly Monday. He might not be able to see his lawyer for that time. And there's a concern that national tactic has been developed in which a person gets charged with a felony and then is held incommunicado. In that context, can you tell me what's been going on here at the Occupy camp?
Well, we've been out here occupying. We started at City Hall in an effort to make some noise and raise some awareness and spread our message, which is basically the abolishment of ICE. We want to be heard. We want the mayor to do what he can to switch up some of these policies, if that's a possibility. Or I'm seeing in other states where sheriffs are canceling contracts with ICE. And I feel like him being police commissioner here, he should have a little bit more pull over ICE and their ongoings here. I feel like he could do a lot more than what he's doing. He won't come and talk to us. He told us that he would come out last week and speak with us. Still hasn't done it. We don't have the support from City Hall that we feel like these families and the children and parents and guardians therein need. We want that support, and he should be supporting us a lot better than what he is.
Tell me about conditions here across from City Hall. This is Chapman Square Park, so y'all have been spending the night here protesting the city's collaboration with Immigration and Customs Enforcement under the Trump administration. I've heard that you've been subjected to blatant and ongoing harassment.
Yes. One of the first nights we were here, this lady drove by. It was broad daylight, actually. She drove by and she started snatching down our signage that we had up along the walkway there.
She got out of her car.
And when she got out of the car and started snatching signs down, I assume her daughter, couldn't have been anywhere older than 11 to 13. She actually drove off without her and then didn't come to a complete stop. And we're like, get your kid. Your kid's outside of the car. And she's kind of like a rolling stop to let her child get back in. That was kind of gut-wrenching because you hate us out here so much that you're putting your own child at risk. You almost ran your own kid over. People almost would rather be ignorant, it seems like, than come and talk to us and understand why we're here and what we're trying to do.
Ironic, because it's about protecting kids, and then she ran off without a kid.
Absolutely. It's all about the kids, for the most part. We worry about their parents and things like that, but more so the kids, because the kids, a lot of them can't speak for themselves. Just how they're being treated is messed up, and they need people to stand up for them. Another guy just the other night pulled up. He had parked up the street for about 30 minutes in a black truck, and then when he came down, he put this mask over. It was like a black mask and a skeleton print on it, and drove by and gave us a long honk. But you know how the boats, when they're coming out of port, they have to honk that horn, and it's like really loud?
Yeah, an air horn?
It was beyond an air horn. It was air horn times 7,000 on his truck, and honk all the way down the street. Someone almost wrecked into the police vehicles here because they were talking trash to us, turning the corner, and almost wrecked. Like, the hate is so real. And these are people who are telling us, they just say, get a job. Or they don't even say, well, what are you doing this for? Like, this whole time, even over in front of the ICE building, my whole thing was just come down and educate yourself. Talk to us and figure out what we're doing, because I'm pretty sure there's a lot of people out here with kids. It'll resonate. It'll hit home. You know, you just happen to not be in the position that these people are with their kids.
I understand there's another person who comes by in a pickup truck with pepper spray.
That was last night. I actually have pictures of that I put up on social media just so people can be aware. That was a gray lifted, souped up Dodge truck. There were about four men in the car. The front window was down. The back window came down slowly, and it was a can of Bear Mace about this big, that round.
Indicating maybe a 20-ounce bottle of Bear Mace.
Yeah, and then they carried on across the bridge, and they didn't come back, which is good because we literally were just standing there on the corner, and nobody even noticed them pull up until they were in our face. And then they started talking trash, and then the back window rolls down. But, like, why do you come and do this? I just want people to educate themselves. And a lot of this stuff happens sometimes at 3 and 4 in the morning, which is crazy because you're, like, staying up late to come and hate on us. It's ridiculous. You're losing sleep to come and be me.
That was KBOO reporter Teresa Mitchell speaking with Danielle James, who is one of the protesters calling on Mayor Ted Wheeler to refuse all cooperation with Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
In an attempt to reduce the country's rapidly accelerating hyperinflation, Venezuela is launching a new currency that cuts 5 zeros off the depreciating bills. This move devalues the Venezuelan bolivar by 95% and pegs it to the government's oil-based cryptocurrency, the petro. Banks are closed today as they prepare to release the sovereign bolivar. The new currency includes two coins and paper bills that range from 2 to 500 bolivars. The 2 bolivar bill has the same buying power as 200,000 of the current currency, while 500 is equal to 50 million. Both the previous and new currencies will remain in circulation during a transitional period. The government also increased the exchange rate from 250,000 bolivars per U.S. dollar to 6 million. President Nicolas Maduro announced a 3,000% hike in the minimum wage and a rise in the price of fuel to international levels. The new minimum wage will be the equivalent of about $30 per month. A person on minimum wage will receive around 1,800 sovereign bolivars a month rather than 1.8 million of the previous bolivar. Some economic analysts say this will only make conditions worse for the country. Venezuela has already seen hyperinflation at more than 40,000% in a rapidly contracting economy. The International Monetary Fund estimated the Venezuelan economy will reach 1,000,000% inflation by the end of 2018.
Longtime opposition politician Imran Khan was confirmed as Prime Minister of Pakistan on Friday. Khan was once one of the most successful cricket players in Pakistan and retired in 1992 to pursue philanthropic projects, eventually founding the Pakistan Movement for Justice Party, or PTI, in 1996. He became the party's leader and was elected to the National Assembly in 2002. The PTI swept the recent assembly elections, and Khan was elected prime minister by the delegates in a landslide. His party's platform includes the creation of an Islamic welfare state, an end to religious discrimination, and accountability across the board. Khan's most pressing concerns are Pakistan's economic crisis and accusations from the country's more established political parties that the recent elections were rigged by the military. Pakistan's government has flipped between semi-democratic civilian leadership and military strongmen since 1947. Khan's promise of increased accountability was a major driver in his party's success in a country whose government is widely perceived as corrupt and beholden to elites. Last night, in his first official address as prime minister, Khan announced a series of austerity measures and said he would not be staying in the vast prime minister's residence with its staff of 500, instead living in his military secretary's house with only a staff of 2.
A recent outbreak of Ebola in the eastern Congo has claimed 50 lives as of this morning. The region is difficult to access, and decades-long conflicts have caused widespread displacement and a lack of basic resources. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has more on the international response.
The recent Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, began on August 1st. As of this morning, the death toll has reached 50 people. And nearly 2,000 people are potentially affected. The outbreak so far is confined to North Kivu, a province in the eastern DRC that has seen conflict and other crises almost uninterrupted for over 2 decades. Mercy Corps is a Portland-based international aid organization with a long-term presence in the eastern Congo. Their deputy country director for the DRC, Whitney Elmer, is back in the U.S. and stopping in Portland this week. I was able to speak with her this afternoon about Mercy Corps' role in the response to this latest outbreak.
So we're working with the Ministry of Health for the Ebola response and the World Health Organization as well. They've actually been very impressive in their quickness or speediness in terms of responding. And this is the 10th Ebola outbreak in DRC. So they've had some practice and they've had some experience now to kind of hone in, you know, what exactly needs to be done.
An effective response to an as yet incurable disease like Ebola is based on containment and prevention. The current outbreak in DRC is occurring in an area that is home to around 400,000 people, located near Goma, a major city of roughly 1 million people, making containment an urgent priority. As Elmer explains, Mercy Corps and other responders are able to apply lessons from the unprecedented West African outbreak a few years ago to the current situation.
We were a key actor in Liberia in responding to the Ebola a few years back, and I think for us it's helped us be more prepared as an agency to respond quickly. So within the last 2.5 weeks since the current outbreak was declared in DRC, we've already trained up our entire field teams on prevention, on, you know, general awareness around Ebola, because this is the first time that in this part of the country it's been hit. So, you know, making sure our teams are informed and best prepared of how to respond. And then also programmatically, we have tools available. We have awareness raising materials already available that we can quickly adapt to the context in DRC. So it's helped us definitely be more prepared and then be able to respond as quickly as possible. We've already deployed team members to those areas, and they've already started activities around awareness raising and prevention activities, but then also, you know, installing emergency hand washing stations. We've been doing some assessment work as well to make sure that water and sanitation facilities are clean and that they're adequate in those areas that are affected.
This Wednesday, August 22nd, Mercy Corps is holding an event at noon at their downtown headquarters, where Elmer and others will be educating the public about the outbreak and the international response. Mercy Corps' HQ is located at 43 Southwest NATO Parkway at the west end of the Burnside Bridge. A full version of the interview with Mercy Corps' Deputy Country Director for the DRC, Whitney Elmer, will air tomorrow at 5:45 at the end of the KBOO Evening News and will be posted online at kboo.fm. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman in Portland.
A new report released today argues that climate change is now reaching the end game, where very soon humanity must choose between taking unprecedented action or accept that it is too late and bear the consequences. The Australian academic report titled What Lies Beneath, the Understatement of Existential Climate Risk, challenges the tendency of the world's scientific community to downplay the potentially irreversible and cataclysmic impacts of climate change. The authors say this caution is itself a threat that should no longer be tolerated. If humanity is to be motivated to make the rapid and far-reaching transition away from fossil fuels and other emission-generating industries. While the report states that, quote, a fast emergency-scale transition to post-fossil fuel world is absolutely necessary to address climate change, end quote, it bemoans the fact that this solution continues to be excluded from the global policy debate because it is considered to be powerful as too disruptive. However, the paper argues it is precisely this lack of imagination and political that could doom humanity's future.
And now from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. A stately brick mansion built before the Civil War is getting a 21st century update. Solar panels. Last year, the city of Roswell, Georgia purchased Mimosa Hall, a 6,000 square foot Greek Revival home built in 1841.
We came up with the idea of putting a solar roof on the property as a way to help the city offset the cost of electricity, so the citizens of Roswell don't have to pay for it themselves.
Steve Gibson is with Friends of Mimosa Hall and Gardens, a nonprofit that supports the preservation of the property. He says the solar panels will generate all the electricity the mansion needs, and batteries will store excess energy for use at night and during cloudy days. Donations and tax credits will help pay for the system, And once installed, the solar panels should save the city more than $5,000 a year. Gibson says Mimosa Hall will demonstrate that clean energy is a modern way to help preserve treasures of the past.
We're hoping to set a new standard for solar use in all kinds of different environments, even in an environment like an historical home. And we really want to build on the momentum that solar energy has today.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The public is advised to avoid contact with the Willamette River between Clackamas Park and Willamette Falls until a nearby sewage leak is repaired. The leak was first noticed Friday in the channel bottom of a manhole in the waterfront area of Oregon City. The leak is located near the old Blue Heron Paper Company property, which in 2011 was the last of the city's major waterfront industries to close its doors. Clackamas County's Water and Environment Services tested the water yesterday and found no evidence the leak has reached the Willamette. However, given the proximity of the leak to the river, residents are still discouraged from swimming, floating, or kayaking in the area until the county can make permanent repairs. A temporary patch reduced the flow of the leak, but no timetable was announced for full repairs.
Tonight, there'll be an open house in the city of Fairview to present the city's urban renewal plans to the public. Fairview's a small city with a population of around 9,300 people located north of Gresham. Fairview's Urban Renewal Advisory Committee has been hammering out a plan all summer, with a financial review meeting still to come on September 12th. The plan has a number of prongs, but the overall goal is to get the city geared up for increased commercial development. This involves the planned rezoning and redevelopment of a number of large areas of vacant and sometimes built-up property. Funds are being put aside for demolition, utility upgrades, and substantial development of water wells on these lots. Another major component of the plan is redevelopment along Halsey, Sandy, and Northeast 223rd Street. The city hopes to turn Halsey into a so-called Main Street area to attract new development. Other components include a park-and-ride station, incentivizing so-called live-work developments, and pedestrian improvements. The timetable calls for the creation of a new urban renewal agency, empowered to enact the plan beginning this December. The Fairview Urban Renewal Open House is tonight at 7:15 p.m., located at 1300 Northeast Village Street.
KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu has this story from the Oregon News Service, which asks, is it time for law enforcement to start treating white supremacist groups the way they treat other street gangs?
Portland has become a hotspot for far-right rallies that often turn violent. Could more be done if the groups holding these rallies were thought of as gangs? Two criminologists believe so, and they say groups like the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer, which organized a rally in Portland earlier this month, exhibit the same characteristics as other street gangs. However, Shannon Reed at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte says the gang problem stereotypically is associated with black and brown youth.
Now we have this group of white youth who are doing sort of these same things that we're concerned about, being involved in violence. A lot of the ones that have been interviewed, also drugs and drug sales and all these other street crimes, but they are somehow different, and race plays a huge role in that.
Reed and her colleague says groups like the Proud Boys identify themselves like other gangs by wearing certain clothing brands and have an initiation process. They and other so-called alt-right groups also have a public presence, often intimidating local communities. Matthew Velasic, a criminologist at Louisiana State University, says police departments have been hesitant to label white supremacist groups as street gangs. For instance, before Portland police purged their gang member database last year, less than 10% were from white power groups, and more than 80% were from some racial or ethnic group. But Velasic says police could add another tool to their toolbox if they thought of white supremacist groups like other street gangs.
If law enforcement were to go more in this direction and treat them more accordingly as a street gang, then there'd be a whole host of possibilities for them to intervene with these groups as opposed to kind of what's happening now.
Velasic says the focused deterrent method is one tool where law enforcement tells gang members it's dedicated to pursuing the group if it continues to be violent and disruptive. Groups from the left also have been present at white supremacist rallies in Portland, protesting these groups and sometimes turning violent. Some criminologists have made the case for describing groups like Antifa as gangs as well. Reed says it doesn't have to be that either one group is a gang or the other isn't, but notes that the white power rallies have been the catalyst for violent protests.
Step one is we have not been dealing with this violent group of white supremacists, white nationalists at all.
This is Yasemin Kobanoglu with a story from the Oregon News Service.
An old sexual assault kit was finally tested after 8 years, leading to the conviction of a Portland native. Stephen Guy Tubbs assaulted a woman who was described as physically helpless and mentally incapacitated in his home. Multnomah County found him guilty of 2 counts of first-degree rape and 2 counts of first-degree sexual abuse. The woman, who was 25 at the time and under the influence of alcohol and cocaine during the attack, had passed out in Tubbs' Jansen Beach condo 8 years ago on December 1st. When the woman woke up after the incident, Tubbs told her he had engaged in sexual activity with her while she was asleep. On December 2nd, she filed a police report. The woman's sexual assault kit was locked away in the Portland police warehouse for years. After her report and examination, there was a delay of 9 months before the Portland Police Sex Crimes Unit responded. One of the officers attempted to reach the woman to give her the name of the sergeant who was assigned to her case, but failed to contact her. It wasn't until September 2011 that police again attempted to reach the woman and were again unsuccessful. According to the Oregonian, the woman was suffering from anxiety and preferred not to pursue the case. The kit was never sent to a lab for examination. In 2015, the district attorney's office received a grant to test the dozens of kits in a Utah facility. The woman's kit was among them. Portland police reopened the case in 2016 after the results came back. Tubbs was arrested in February 2017 and has a history of sexual assault. He's a registered sex offender and has served 2 years in prison. Tubbs will be sentenced on Wednesday.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a live in-depth interview with Tesla City Stories, a live radio theater in Portland. At 6, it's Labor Radio. That's followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 66 degrees. Tomorrow, we will have a high of 96 degrees with persistent smoke and haze. Today in history, in 1911, the first around-the-world telegram was sent from the New York Times office. It traveled more than 28,000 miles in under 17 minutes. The telegram simply read, quote, "This message sent around the world," end quote. The quote of the day is from the late Elmore Leonard, a best-selling crime writer. He said, quote, "It doesn't have to make sense, it just has to sound like it does."
Last Friday, August 17th, 2 skateboarders were targeted by a man walking a Jack Russell Terrier dog, and one of the skateboarders was stabbed. The 2 skateboarders made comments which apparently triggered the man, who looked to be in his early 50s, taking his dog for a walk on the Barrows Park Trail in Tigard. The man began arguing with the skateboarders and then took out a knife and proceeded to slash one of the skateboarders' legs. The other skateboarder took his board and smashed the man over the head with it. The man ran off with his dog and is still at large. The knife attack victim was taken to OHSU, but his injuries were not life-threatening.
A march in support of immigrants and refugees yesterday in East Portland drew over 2,000 participants. The marchers held signs welcoming immigrants and criticizing the current administration's policy of family separation. Mayor Ted Wheeler was absent from the event, although he was initially scheduled to appear. He has come under fire from immigrant rights advocates for his decision to sweep the Occupy ICE encampment that held a 24-hour vigil against the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office in Portland for several weeks. Yesterday, police harassed the immigrant rights protesters who have continued the vigil across from City Hall. One person was arrested.
TriMet recently announced that it's preparing to launch the largest service expansion in its history. The regional transit agency is planning to increase services on numerous routes beginning September 2nd. The expansion is partly funded by an increase in the agency's payroll tax that was approved by the board of directors, as well as its share of a new statewide payroll tax that was approved by the Oregon legislature in 2017. According to TriMet, the service expansion includes nearly 1,000 more weekly hours of bus service, around 700 more weekly bus trips, better frequency or more capacity on 13 bus lines, and many additional trips on its busiest MAX lines. One of the most significant changes is that the expansion will mean the return of 24-hour bus service to the Portland area for the first time in over 30 years.
Last month, a Portland native saved herself from an attacker by pulling out a concealed carry handgun from her bag, causing the attacker to flee. The attacker has now been arrested. The Portland woman was entering her apartment building located on Northeast Shaver Street when she noticed Marquise Savelle Harges in the apartment lobby. Harges got into the elevator with the woman and then proceeded to shoot up crystal meth. When the woman had entered her apartment, Harges followed her in. Harges took $60 in cash and a pill bottle, exposed himself to the woman, and asked her to perform a sexual act on him. The woman then pulled her handgun from her purse and the man ran off. After the break-in, the woman told a friend of the incident. The friend took photos of the man leaving the building and gave the photos to the Portland police. Police identified the man immediately. Harges was arrested earlier in the week by TriMet officers on charges of burglary, attempted sodomy, and attempted sex abuse. He's scheduled to appear in court on Wednesday.
Thousands of people attended the annual HempFest Protestival last weekend in Seattle, Washington. KBOO's own Doug McVeigh was a speaker at this year's HempFest, and he brings us this report about a medical marijuana research project at the University of Washington.
So I'm Dr. Michelle Bedard-Gilligan, and I'm assistant professor at the University of Washington in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences.
And you're here at HempFest talking about Project STEP. Tell me about it.
So Project STEP is a research study that we have going on. It's funded by the National Institute of Drug Abuse. And what it's looking at is it's trying to explore the effects of cannabis on PTSD recovery, so recovery of post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms.
Are you taking in people who are already in some kind of treatment? Or are you would it be mostly people who are in some sense self-medicating, or what?
So either or. So we're taking individuals who meet criteria for PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder, so have prominent symptoms that are causing them impairment, and are using cannabis on a regular basis, so daily or near daily. And some folks are using it, you know, under the care of a prescriber. Some people are using it recreationally. It sort of depends. And either is fine, but we're looking for individuals with that co-occurrence, so that PTSD and the regular cannabis use. And what we're looking at is to see how they respond to a PTSD therapy. So we're giving a very brief 6-session therapy. We can give it over the course of 2 weeks because sessions are pretty close to daily. And we want to see how individuals who have PTSD and are using cannabis in this way respond to that treatment.
Fascinating. I need to ask, would you be monitoring for other drug use? Would other drug therapies sort of create conflicts with your data?
So yes, we do monitor for other drug use. So we ask people to be stable on prescription medications for 3 months prior to enrolling in the trial, so that we can see kind of isolate the effects of the cannabis use specifically. Other drug use or other substance use like alcohol or other, you know, recreational substances, sometimes they are accepted, sometimes they're not. It just sort of depends on how often it's being used. And again, we need to isolate the effects of cannabis, so we want to have as clear of a sample as we can in terms of who enrolls in the trial.
Now, would participants have to be residents of Washington, and how would people become involved in the in your trial?
Great question. So you don't have to be a resident of Washington, but you do have to be available to attend therapy sessions, so the treatment sessions. Again, we do about 6 of them, and they're usually scheduled over the course of 2 weeks. And so if someone can come and visit Seattle for 2 weeks and come do therapy here, that's great. They can come from anywhere. But most of our participants are local. And you can find out about our trial by going to our website. So www.uwprojectstep.org. So that's www.uwprojectstep.org.
That was University of Washington Assistant Professor Michelle Bedard-Gilligan, Principal Investigator for Project STEP, speaking with KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh at this year's Seattle HempFest.
A woman was killed by an alligator while walking her dog through a South Carolina resort on Monday. The woman, Cassandra Klein, was walking her dog in a residential area when she was attacked by an 8-foot alligator who was originally trying to get her dog. The alligator was later found and killed. The alligator managed to bite the dog's leash, with Klein pulling back to rescue her dog. A maintenance worker came over to help the woman during the attack. The dog was left unharmed. Alligator attacks are said to be rare. There have only been 20 alligator attacks in the state since 1976.
Today, voting rights groups sent a pre-lawsuit demand letter to a voting district in Georgia that's planning to close more than 75% of the county's polling places and voting precincts prior to the November 2018 election. The proposed consolidations would eliminate 7 out of Randolph County's 9 voting precincts, including one in which nearly 100% of the voters are black. Lawyers argue this would severely burden many low-income minority residents, particularly those who live in rural areas, lack access to transportation, or work long or inflexible hours. The burden of these changes will be felt most acutely by black voters, who are more than 3 times as likely as whites to lack access to a vehicle in Randolph County. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law has been working with local organizations to combat the proposed plan since it was publicly released. A lawsuit is in the works to challenge the Randolph County Board of Elections decision.
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from our host, Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1619. That was the day that the first ship bearing enslaved people arrived in North America. It was an English warship called the White Lion that came to Johnstown in the colony of Virginia. The ship was a privateer and had captured 20-odd enslaved people from a Portuguese ship in a raid. Virginian planters were interested in forced labor to work the tobacco fields in the colony. The laws surrounding slavery in Virginia evolved over time. Throughout the 1600s, statutes replacing indentured servants to race-based slavery for life were written into the law books. In 1654, John Kaiser became the first person enslaved under the rule of law in North America. By 1662, a law was passed that children would be considered enslaved or free based on the status of their mother in Virginia. This meant that slavery could pass down from generation to generation. This and similar laws ensured slavery would grow. Historians estimate that 388,000 enslaved people came to what became the United States from Africa. Due to laws passing down slavery to children, by the Civil War, there were nearly 4 million enslaved people in the South. By the early 1800s, enslaved people made up about 1/3 of the Southern population. Initially, enslaved labor worked predominantly to produce crops like tobacco, indigo, and also rice. Some West Africans had developed valuable skills in rice cultivation that white landowners exploited through slavery. With the invention of the cotton gin in 1793, cotton became increasingly important to the Southern economy. The South's dependence on slave labor became more entrenched and spread westward with the growing United States until the Civil War ended the brutality of slavery.
One of the first of dozens of women to accuse Harvey Weinstein of sexual assault, as well as a pioneer of the Me Too movement, has been found to have been paid off by a man who accused her of sexual assault. Assia Argento, an actress and filmmaker, was accused of sexually assaulting Jimmy Bennett, an actor and musician, at a Los Angeles hotel when Bennett was 17 years old. Argento was 37 at the time. The age of consent in the state of California is 18, making it possible that Argento can be charged with statutory rape. Argento invited Bennett to her hotel room while a family member of Bennett's was present. Argento told the family member to leave, leaving her alone with Bennett. Argento provided the minor with alcohol and then proceeded to show him letters she had wrote to him before pushing him onto the bed and forcibly engaging in sexual acts. Afterward, Argento told the actor to take photos of themselves together. The documents were received anonymously through encrypted email and showed both Argento and Bennett in bed. Bennett had given Argento the copyright and photo according to the agreement. Bennett, who is now 22, is asking 42-year-old Argento for up to $3.5 million in damages. Argento previously paid Bennett $380,000. Though Bennett spoke out about the assault, he cannot sue Argento, according to the agreement.
3 people were murdered and 2 were injured during a drive-by shooting in Nashville, Tennessee. Two men driving a dark-colored Chevrolet murdered three people and injured two as the victims walked down the streets and parking lots last Friday. The three people who were at a bar left to go get snacks in a nearby convenience store. As they were leaving, they were confronted by two men in the parking lot of the establishment and told that it was a robbery. One of the victims told the men in the car that he had nothing to give and was then shot. The two other victims were then taken to the hospital, but died during treatment. The robbers later dumped the belongings of their victims in an alley. Nashville police believe that these murders are related to another killing of a man attempting to catch a bus on Tuesday, August 14th. Witnesses saw the men in the car and identified them as two black men in their 30s driving a dark-colored vehicle. Several other robberies this month could also be attributed to the same two men.
Donald Trump tweeted this morning that he hopes former CIA Director John Brennan sues over the revoking of his security clearance. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said Brennan's clearance was stripped due to, quote, erratic behavior and perpetual dishonesty. Conversely, Trump said it was pulled due to the Russia investigation. The president also questioned Attorney General Jeff Sessions' leadership of the Justice Department. Brennan had been very critical of Trump prior to the loss of his security clearance, even suggesting the president is drunk on power. Former CIA Director and Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta warned that security clearances could be used as a political tool in the Trump administration. Panetta said, quote, security clearances are critical to our national security, and decisions regarding security clearances ought to be based on national security issues. Our concern now is that security clearances are going to be used as a political tool to go after people the president doesn't agree with or issues that the president may not agree with, and that undermines the importance of security clearances, particularly when it comes to national security.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for August 20th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Summer Barraza, Sam Bowman, Yasmin Kobanoglu, Doug McVeigh, Joe Myers, Teresa Mitchell, and Jenka Soderberg. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff and the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Mike Factalis, and the interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Philomath on translator K282BH at 104.3 FM and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Summer Barraza.
And I'm Ken Jones. At 7, it's Democracy Now! Coming up on Tuesday morning with Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Then at 8 a.m. tomorrow, the Abe and Joe Talk radio show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9, on alternative radio, journalist and author Chris Hedges asks, what are citizens to do when faced with moral imperatives? At 10, it's Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio, D-May features two new premiere productions at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Snow in Midsummer and The Way the Mountain Moved. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, we feature interviews with artists, curators, and critics. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Summer. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I don't know what these casting directors are looking for. You're my agent, Milk. You tell me. I mean, I got a dazzling smile.
Oh, sure.
And I've got what Jack calls a couple of grade A gams. Mm,
not bad at all.
And I got poise and grace and all that junk. And what's more, I can sing like a nightingale.
A wounded albatross, maybe.
Today, August 20th, is National Radio Day, a day to celebrate radio and recognize the importance of our medium. At one time, not too long ago, radio was the nation's primary channel for news and entertainment. With the advent of newer media, namely TV and the internet, the golden age of radio has come and gone. However, we might very well be living through the golden age of live radio theater here in Portland. That's thanks to troops like Tesla City Stories, who after a brief hiatus are returning to the stage next month. At a Tesla City Story show, you'll experience an evening of live radio theater with scripts from the archives of the little-known Tesla Broadcasting Company, a radio network that operated between 1943 and 1945. These scripts include a variety of shows from the Golden Age, sitcoms, mysteries, thrillers, westerns, and science fiction, and they're performed live on stage, just as they were back in the old days, complete with music and sound effects. Tesla City Stories' new season premieres Friday, September 7th at 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in downtown Portland. Here to give us an inside look is the group's co-founder and producer, Jerry Christman, and Tesla City's newest resident, Sam Mowry. Jerry and Sam, thanks for joining us at KBOO today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us on National Radio Day.
Thanks for having us back. It's great to be here.
Very appropriate. Jerry, let's start with you. For KBOO listeners who might be hearing about you for the first time, how would you describe Tesla City Stories?
Well, Tesla City Stories, my partner, show partner, who also directs the show and archives the show, he discovered these scripts a few years ago through a combination of events. And if you're interested, it's on our website, the whole history of how he found it. However, working at Powell's and his own interest, he discovered these amazing old scripts that are hardly known anywhere. And they're public domain, so he came to me and said, we should put these up, you know, we should perform these out in the world. And I thought about it, and I said, let's do it. And we started early on. We're now entering our fourth year. And we started in a little tiny black box theater, and then we moved to a bigger theater. And now we're moving into our 28th performance, which will be at our new venue at the Old Church, which we are thrilled about. So that's where we're at. Our show is variety. There's never the same show twice. There's something for everybody, and it's really hard to not have a good time at our show, we feel.
And as you mentioned, it's not only entertainment, it's really cultural archaeology is what you're doing, preserving these scripts for a newer generation.
It is. It's very interesting to look back and see where we were and what was popular at the time and compare them to how we are now. And many of the things are quite the same, especially when it comes to drama and fiction. You know, a lot
and
of
dramedy.
Same. And dramedy, too.
I think that's
right?
A word.
It is.
I've heard it before.
They have andromedy back then.
Now,
we just couldn't tell.
We mentioned that you started in April 2014, so over 4 years ago, but you're entering your third season. There was, I mentioned in the intro, it was a brief hiatus, and that was because you had to switch theaters, right?
We did. Unfortunately, our theater, due to forces beyond our control, shut down. And so we took our time. We wanted to find the right place for our venue and for our fans, or find the right venue for our fans and ourselves. And we are really lucky to be at the Old Church. It's a beautiful historic venue downtown. The staff there is great, and the room itself is really unique. The acoustics are amazing.
Well, and you need more than just a regular room. Part of the Tesla City Stories is there's food and drink and, you know, cigarette girls and
yes,
the whole,
there's a cigarette girl.
The whole experience, which is hard to find in a regular theater.
This is true. We work really hard to provide. It's more of an event, and it's interaction. There's audience participation, and it's a unique night out. We used to call it most unique night out, but that's, I've been informed, is not grammatically correct. So we think it's Portland's best night out.
Is it the uniquest?
Well, unique. You can't be the most unique, apparently.
Okay.
Literature degree, not linguistics. Thank you very much.
Now, we mentioned some of the amenities Sam did. I've got from your website, as opposed to the Fremont, better parking, text message, tickets, easier access to public transit, more room in the seating and bar area, spacious padded seating, the same alcohol and snacks. The same cigarette girl.
There's a parking lot right on the corner.
Oh, two. Right. Okay.
There are now two cigarette girls. And there is a parking lot next door. It's the Portland streetcar runs right there. It's centralized, so we're really thrilled. It's easy to get to.
We should mention there's still the live music, right? You have intermission with live music.
That's correct. We have vintage music. This, our premiere, we'll have Anna Paul and the Bearded Lady, who is just a delight to hear. So it's a night full of all different laughs, chills, thrills, music, prizes, you name it, we've got it.
Ventriloquism, dancing.
Juggling.
Oh, everything you need in radio.
Jerry's got to get on it with the ventriloquists and the jugglers, because I don't think he had planned that, Sam. But you're one of the two new members of Tesla City Troop troop this season. And I can't pronounce her name, along with Michelle, Jerry,
Now she's been working me on this. Apolitegi.
Okay.
Apolitegi.
Apolitegi.
And we're thrilled to have her, and we're very thrilled to have Sam A. Mowry with us. Sam is a veteran of radio and vintage radio, and we're just so grateful that he's decided to join us.
I would describe Sam as the best radio voice in the state, certainly I would argue in favor. And Sam, you're also the artistic director of the Willamette Radio Workshop.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that group and your role with them?
Well, we started in 2001. It was just a group of actors and sound designers and writers who had an affinity for old-time radio. And we decided to see if we could actually put on some old-time shows. And like everyone, we did War of the Worlds, and it went over really well. And and we've been, you know, producing ever since. We're generally at McMinniman's, either at the Kennedy School, or we do the UFO Festival down in McMinnville. We do Halloween and the Tolkien Festival at Kennedy School. And we did 5 years up in Vancouver, but we were set free.
Back
in Portland. Yes, at the Kiggins Theater. Beautiful, beautiful spot up there. Lovely people. But you have to cross the bridge, and that's never any fun. But we were very excited to come here. As soon as I found out about Tesla, I was very fascinated and came and met with Jerry and Brendan. And, you know, they're amazingly talented. And it's a great show and a great group of people that they put together. And, you know, there's a lot of backstory with the show, but the other thing is, don't be afraid of that, because each show completely stands on its own, and you can just come and enjoy the heck out of each episode, and you don't have to know anything about it, because it's a great story, well acted, and you know, you're going to have a great time. So I'm very excited about coming in and getting to work with some other people who are as in love with the radio as I am.
I want to point out that we have three shows in our fall season. In the October show, October 19th, Sam is going to be, we're really looking forward to this. He's going to be playing in both of the stories of the night, the supernatural crime fighter known as the Wraith. And that will be his debut as that character. We cannot wait. It'll be a Halloween themed show.
Did you have any models for that? Who was the original? Lamont Cranston.
Does have that shadow esque feel with Lamont Cranston, the shadow. But you know, it's its own thing. It's unique, but it definitely has that supernatural feel and kind of the power to cloud men's minds.
Was there any kind of adjustment you had to make going from Willamette Radio Workshop? I should mention you're still a part of that.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
to,
yeah.
To your
no,
work
yeah,
on
please,
Tesla
no, we're
Radio,
still,
Tesla it, City Stories.
Much easier for me, because I don't have to do all the work that I do. We've got Jerry and Brendan doing all the work I did and acting in it. So I'm actually really looking forward to being able to come in and be directed by Brendan and produced by Jerry, and just really get to enjoy flexing my muscles as a voice actor alone, which I don't usually have that opportunity. So I'm very excited about that, because they're great shows and a lot of fun, and I've never worked on any of these scripts before, and after 17 years I've done, you know, a ton of
yes.
old-time radio, and we've
and
written tons
scripts,
of original stuff, and so this is a completely different animal, and I'm really looking forward to getting to write it.
We're really thrilled to be producing and presenting these stories, because they are unique. They haven't been heard since the 40s. And also, there's a unique facet of it. Brendan wanted me to mention that in October in the Wraith episodes. It's a crossover episode, so we're going to see characters from all the stories appear in this one episode. And that's what makes these stories unusual. It was the only scripts that we've ever found where the characters and storylines will intersect. Usually, old radio was self-contained. Might have a guest star now and then, but there's a whole Tesla universe of characters, and that's going to be highlighted in October.
And that's where the original Tesla broadcasting was extremely innovative, even though they lasted only about 2-3 years or so, huh?
And one of the things, too, Brendan always talks about in the show, he gives some history on the Tesla broadcasting company, and it's really interesting. So we're really looking forward to it.
In some ways, it reminds me of, do you remember the AMC series Remember When? WENN, about a fictional radio station in Pittsburgh during the 40s. And, you know, it's this plucky little group of actors, and they do everything. You know, they do the news, they do the westerns, they do the comedies, they do the dramas, and that very much is kind of the feel with Tesla, is that group of people who are the perfect amalgamation for radio. They can do anything at the drop of a hat and do it well and have a great time doing it.
And when you mention that, I want to ask you, since I know you're a big fan and a student of old-time radio, what do you think the attraction of radio theater, especially live on stage, is for us today, where we have the internet, we have television, we have movies?
I was just working with somebody this afternoon who's doing another radio podcast storytelling project, and we were talking about this, and one of the things I think is that with all of the imagery and all the screens and all the colors and everything that comes flashing at everybody all the time, that there's really a place for having a voice in your ear telling you a story. And I think that young people especially respond to that really, really well. And it's one of the things I always love at our shows, and I also see at the Tesla shows, is we have audiences from, you know, 10-year-old kids to 90-year-olds, and they all come and they all love it, and they all get the concept of active listening, which is you right. listen to it and you create your own images and you create your own world that you're in. And if the radio artists do it right, it's an incredible experience.
One of my favorite things to do is look out in the audience in the middle of the stories, and I can see quite a number of people who have their eyes closed. So that's really good. And not because they're sleeping.
Oh, it's
because
no,
they're either actively listening, trying to imagine. That's really, really neat. Plus, back then, radio was the internet.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's collaborative, as you mentioned. It's something between the artists and the audience, where the audience have to fill in the gaps, the things that are not shown. So you don't get that sensory overload. I mean, I go to a movie now, it's all explosions and quick cuts.
And then also, it's the kind of thing that you can take with you, and the stories are usually in some sort of serialized or, you know, half-hour, hour-long chunks. So it's, you know, when you're taking a bus ride in from Gresham, you can listen to an entire story on your way in, and, you know, it's not like some audiobook that you have to just keep getting back to where was I, what was going on. Everything's right there. So I think that really works with the modern audience.
And we're lucky. We have such a great cast that we've been able to assemble, so much talent and a great crew, and, and we really, really enjoy doing the show. And by the way, I have a discount I want to offer.
My next question was going to ask you where listeners can find out more information to buy tickets. So now you're going to give them a code.
I am psychic. I must have read your mind.
Okay.
The website is teslacitystories.com, and the code for a 15% discount on each ticket for all the tickets is KBOO, KBOO. Just put that in and it'll take care of you.
And of course, they could also go to Facebook to find out more information through the page there. And Sam, let's not give short shrift to Willamette Radio Workshop. Where can listeners find out more about your upcoming shows?
Our website is www.radiowork.com. And we have a Facebook page, which you can sign up, become a member. We don't spam people very much, so we just let you know when we're doing things in a very mellow kind of way. We've got a bunch of stuff coming up in the fall, which I'd be more than happy to come back to and talk to you about
that. Oh, I'd love that. And probably
up next
a Halloween
Tesla
show?
Radio. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
He's a busy man in October.
Yes, but the Tesla is the big thing in the new space. I mean, you've seen shows at the old church before.
Our good friends, Portland Story Theater's there.
Oh, yeah.
Jerry knows them well.
They were influential in persuading us to go there. So,
Well, we used to do the Portland Civic Guild Tuesday readings there, and we did old-time radio there for Christmas for a few years before they moved over to Don Horn's Sanctuary. So it's a beautiful spot for radio.
Well, Jerry and Sam, again, many thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thank you very much.
It is a great experience. And for those of you who have not experienced live radio on stage, this is the show to go to, Tesla City, coming up. So we've been talking with Jerry Christman, co-founder and producer of Tesla City Stories, and newest Tesla City cast member Sam Mowry. The new season launches Friday, September 7th at the Old Church Concert Hall, which is located at 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. Doors at 7, show starts at 8. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
Radio Day.
From your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Help us celebrate by taking a selfie
and posting it on social media.
Hashtag National Radio Day.
Here's to all the great radio in Portland and all over the world.
Happy National Radio Day to you.
Happy National Radio Day
Happy
to
National
you.
National Radio Day.
Happy National Radio Day to you. You.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. This film from 1980 chronicles the life of country singer Loretta Lynn. Sissy Spacek brings sincerity and depth to her portrait of Loretta and does her own singing in the movie, as does Beverly D'Angelo in the role of Patsy Cline. Tommy Lee Jones also delivers one of his best performances. Again, that's Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, I was born to coal miner's daughter.
The time is 6 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Good evening, Portland. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. Welcome to Labor Radio on this smoky, smoky evening here in the Portland metro area. With me in studio tonight is my friend, Connor Toth. Connor.
Thank-